What's up, everybody? Today on the Student Loan Planner podcast, you've got myself, Megan, and Lauren, and we are going to be talking about refunds, refinancing, repay, reconsolidating, all the R's. I think we were trying real hard to pull together a cool, catchy title for this podcast, and we reached hard. So I will flip it over to you, though. Lauren, how are you doing today?
I am doing wonderful. You're right. We are not the head of marketing, but we did. We came up with these R's, and you guys are going to love them. We've got some good things. So, and we're going to kick it off with that refund piece of the puzzle. So I had a really interesting case recently where I spoke to a client, and you know, my recommendation for her was to get a refund. And she went through kind of the process and kind of figured the things out and wanted to report back to me and say, like, hey, I did my consultation. You taught me a lot of different things. My refund process was a little bit crazy, and I just wanted you to know so that maybe you could share it with other borrowers. And I thought that was wonderful. We always say sharing is caring. So if something comes up that you think is unique to you and your experience in the student loan world, you know, the more we know, the more we can help other people. So this client was a physician, or is a physician, that was doing residency in 2020. So kind of graduated into COVID, which, you know, one of the things that's been really frustrating for a lot of people is figuring out, like, what's my strategy when I'm graduating into a time period where no one has to pay their loans. They had 5 direct loans that equaled about $190,000 of student loan debt. They were thinking about, like, maybe going for public service. They're like, okay, I've gone from residency to attending, and they were told by HR that they were not actually eligible for PSLF. So they're like, oh. And this happens so frequently with physicians. Megan, I know you see it frequently as well, where, you know, it's a little bit of confusing about whether or not they qualify. Some people automatically assume they don't because of the type of job that they have. But it is all about where you work and who is actually writing your paycheck. So she came across some colleagues that were doing PSLF, talking about it, and they were getting approved. She's like, wait a minute, hold on a second. I thought I wasn't eligible. And so I hadn't really done anything to get ready for it up to that point, but then realized that, you know, this was something that was on the table. They were on repay the whole 4 years of their residency. And then they had kind of mentally, like, just checked out and said, like, hey, well, residency, you know, was qualifying, but nothing else is going to qualify. So I'm just going to start paying my loans back. So they had 4 years of PSLF credit via residency. At this point, you know, when all this started to kind of come about and they realized that there was, like, an opportunity for getting a refund and, you know, this PSLF waiver and all the different things that were happening, they had paid $80,000 on their loan. So got out of med school or got out of residency and just was like, I'm going to hammer this. I'm going to knock it out. But as per, like, the podcast, like you said, some of the things that we're always trying to share with you all, these little strategies. So they would have been on the standard 10-year repayment. And if you know anything about the standard 10-year repayment, they would have paid their loans off over the period of 10 years. Nothing would be forgiven because they would just be paid in full. And public service loan forgiveness is also a 10-year program. So they had the 4 years of residency, but also all of this time during COVID when they didn't have to pay a penny toward the loans. And so there's 4 years of qualifying credit and 3 of them that they didn't even have to make any payments. So this is a pretty cool opportunity where you're like, okay, well, I didn't make any payments. I'm now 4 years with 6 to go on public service loan forgiveness. PSLF does make sense for me because I did not have to pay during this period where I would have been on the standard repayment plan. So, Megan, is there anything that stands out to you so far about what I've said?
That $80,000, man, whew, that is a big amount of money. They were trucking it. They were, like, really getting down to business with paying this down. So I'm excited to see where this goes.
Yes, I was. I was so shocked to hear. So October rolls around. It's PSLF waiver time. And like I said, that's when they actually found out about, like, oh, all this time period during COVID counts and it's not going to be the full 10 years. So they were like, hold on, let me do the math. Let me get it together. And at this point, it was like almost $100,000 that had been paid. 4 of the 5 loans had been paid off by this time. And this is over a period of 2 years. So like you said, they came out just getting it. Now, the other piece of this puzzle is that all these loans were at Fed loans. So if you've been following along or if you were one of the people that's qualified for public service, you know that Fed loans is a servicer that quit in the middle of COVID. They said no more, no way, no how. And everybody who was being serviced by Fed loans needed to be transferred over to MOHELA. They requested their refund via Fed loans. Something got lost in the shuffle. They ended up only having one loan because everything got paid off before leaving Fed loans. One loan get transferred over to Mohila. And then they wanted their money back because it made sense to pursue public service loan forgiveness after, you know, this math was done and everything was going to play itself out. Fed loans didn't provide any confirmation email or any information related to the refund request. So they had to end up starting over with Mohila. And, you know, when things are getting transferred, things get lost in the shuffle and people just don't want to deal with it. It's a pretty hard process. But persistence is key. So what they did was call once a month to check in. So they requested their refund via Mohila, called once a month to check in.
That's good. I mean, gosh, it stinks that you have to do that, but that's some dedication right there. That's a lot of money on the table.
Exactly. You know, and Mohila wasn't really clear on like how much money was going to come back to them, but they wrote everything down. So March 27th is what they were told. It would be no longer than 90 business days. And so they wrote that down with the person that they got on the phone and they called on the 91st business day.
Wow. That had been marked on their calendars.
Right. Excuse me. Pardon me. You said 90 business days. It's been 91. What's going on here? So they had to escalate to a manager, of course. So it got processed on the 91st business day. But what had to happen behind the scenes was that someone had to call Fed Loans to get the loan reinstated. Then 30 days after that is when they got a check in the mail. Now, that was the other piece of the puzzle, is that Mohila was not able to answer any questions on how the money was going to arrive. Am I going to get direct deposit? Am I going to get a check? They called the Department of Treasury as well to say like, hey, do you know how I'm going to get my money back? They had no clue either. But they did, in fact, get their full refund via check, something like 120 days later, after all of this had played itself out. Now, one of the other things that they pointed out to me was the idea that the loans were reinstated, but they did not carry over the payment plan. And so that is one of the things that is super duper important right now for a lot of people, because they have payment plans from 2018 or 2019, depending on what their particular situation is. And they have income calculated, or they have a payment calculated based on income from way back then. So you absolutely, if you're trying to maximize your student loan strategy, want to have a payment that is as low as humanly possible. And so their payment plan would have been $600 on the previous payment plan they were on, in comparison to a $3,000 payment if they had to update their income and re-sign up for the repay plan. So absolutely did not want a $3,000 payment before you absolutely needed to do that. And so they got more persistent because, as you can see, this person is very much so a persistent person, and called again and had them reinstate their payment plan.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize you could do that. So they were able to reinstate what the total payment was, or like the repayment plan was, prior to them shutting everything off in COVID.
Yes. So wow. They called and initially they said, could you please reinstate my payment plan? Like, this is not the payment plan. Like, I have what my payment was and I it should be the same as it previous was. And they just said no. And that's where, like you said, we always tell our clients to be persistent. So they escalated to a manager. And then a couple of days later, like the manager said, they would get it taken care of. A couple of days later, they logged in and it said it was all repay and it had gone back to the proper payment. So I love this story for so many reasons, because, you know, someone's probably listening and they're like, well, they had $80K to pay on their loans. They should have just paid them off. But you have to think about the financial freedom that comes from having that money back in your pocket and the things you're able to do. So they also shared a little bit about their, you know, their kind of personal story and, you know, why this was so important for them and why this was making such a big deal in their life. They're married with two kids. They've been renting a townhouse for their family of four. They've been cramped in that space. Interest rates went up pretty drastically during the course of this time frame, so they weren't going to be able to buy. They live in a high cost of living place. Now they're going to be able to buy with a 20% down payment. They're doing a 15-year mortgage. And they'll be able to probably, you know, refinance at some point to, you know, drop that interest rate down. But just by them being able to put this money toward their home is going to be a lot more affordable. And that's the reason they're able to get into a house at all. So, you know, sometimes people are, yeah, very judgmental on the, like, should you pay them off or should you not? Or you just taking advantage of the strategies that are available to you. But I think it's absolutely worth the persistence. You know, when someone has two kids, they got to pay for those kids' college. They've got to, you know, take care of the kids, the diapers and all the other things that go with it. Our money is ours. It's a tool to be used to live the life we want. And I'm so happy for this client to be able to have gotten all that money back.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And what a like journey where we have heard, you know, multiple times that, well, we've heard both sides where as far as getting money back, how easy has it been? And so we've heard some folks say, oh, it was pretty simple. All I did was call the servicer. I got it within 4 to 6 weeks. And that's ideally the case. Like ideally, you don't have to chase somebody around for your money. But I think unfortunately, your clients here had like kind of the worst hand where they were at a servicer that shut down and then they had to kind of chase the money because that there's no like, you know, since that servicer is dead and gone at this point, there's not a lot of incentive for anybody to be fast or help you or, you know, get down to the bottom of it. So you have to really be your own advocate. And that's a lot of what is going on just, I think, in general in the student loan system, but more specifically in the PSLF system where, like, if something's wrong, if something isn't accurate, or if it's taking forever to get information about your loan details and your payment history, like you really do have to be your own advocate. You know, unfortunately, that is the case at this time. I know that they're trying to improve the processes by making things faster with like the digital PSLF signature and, you know, just a lot of the things that they're implementing now. But this story really does show a story of persistency and how the persistency can really pay off. And I think that's great. I think, yeah, money is a tool. It is something that gives you flexibility in your life to do other things with. So that's way better served, you know, going back to their family and helping them purchase a home. And, you know, so I'm glad that that came with a good result. Now, question, and you may not know the answer to this, because this was one of my questions for a few clients where this was going to be the case. If you're getting a refund for loans that are completely paid off, so they're obviously not in the federal system to have qualifying payments during the time that they were paid off, when they're reinstated, does the payment count on the loans retain like that COVID time period? Do you know what I mean? Or does that make sense how I'm asking that?
Yeah, no, I think it should, but I don't know definitively that the answer is yes, but everybody's had their payments counted during COVID, either toward the IDR adjustment or toward PSLF. So I don't know why they wouldn't retroactively be counted when they can be. You know, we've also talked to clients about calling in and getting themselves put into the COVID forbearance, people that were in school deferment or other sorts of things. So, you know, technically mm-hmm. weren't on it and then can get on it. I don't see why it would be different, why you wouldn't be able to get on it as you get reinstated.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't seen a definitive answer.
That might be something for those to check then. So if you're someone who completely paid off a loan, this may not matter at all for you if you just got a refund back on like a portion of balance that you had paid. But if you had a loan completely paid off at some point during this COVID forbearance and got it reinstated, just got the refund, got the loan reinstated, just triple check that your payment counts look right for PSLF, maybe resubmit an employment certification form for that time period to make sure that all the loans have the same payment count. You'd want to catch that now since we're still in this account adjustment period versus being surprised about it later. So that's maybe a word of caution.
And I mean, another piece that I think of as you said that is, you know, we're also in the safe zone, whereas if it's not counted, you can consolidate and get it counted for the loans that didn't get paid off. So yeah, now would be the time to stay on top of those things and making sure. And to that point, we talked about this, I think, on a fairly recent episode, but I do want to bring it up again because I actually had it pop up for another client. If you've consolidated the loans, if you've asked for a refund and then you do a consolidation before you get the refund, you will not get your refund. And that has been a really tough thing. So don't jump the gun. You need to wait this process out for the refund and then do the consolidation, because we've gotten a hard no answer for someone who, you know, they did request the refund. They even waited a little bit. They didn't wait completely. And so they did a consolidation. The refund hadn't come yet. And now they're saying that they're not eligible for the refund at all.
Because it's a brand new loan, I guess. Yeah. So that's a good word of advice as well, is if you are waiting on a refund, but you are someone who needs to consolidate, just wait a little bit longer to consolidate until you get that refund in hand. That's also important too, because if you're reinstating loans and you're consolidating, if you consolidate before the reinstatement has happened, those loans are going to be left out of the consolidation altogether. So you'd have to add them in later or reconsolidate again in the future. So it's probably a lot cleaner to where if you're someone in that boat that needs both a refund for any payments you've made since March of 2020, and you need to look at consolidation, start the refund process as soon as possible. Stay on them, just like your client example did, you know, stay on them, check in, make sure it's getting done. And then once that's done, you have the refund in hand, you've seen the loans get reinstated on your loan file, then go ahead and do the consolidation. Because we just have to have the consolidations in by the end of the year for the account adjustment to be applicable. So we have time. Cool. All right. Well, great refund story. I think that also helps us maybe pivot to one of our other topics for today, which was reconsolidation, which again, we're talking a lot about consolidation with the times right now with this account adjustment. Just a quick recap, consolidation is just combining the existing loans that you have into one direct consolidation loan, and or converting the existing loans that you have from one of the older loan types, which was called an FFEL or Family Federal Education Loan, which these guys were issued before 2010. So if you borrowed after 2010, no sweat, you will not have these types of loans. But converting those types into a direct consolidation loan, that there's a lot of benefits to consolidation right now with rounding up payment counts to the highest payment count that any one loan has. And then, of course, the account adjustment is not applicable to those FFEL loans. So if we need the account adjustment to be applied to your account, we need to do the consolidation to convert those loan types. So one of the kind of confusing things about consolidation right now when we're meeting with clients is someone will think that they've already consolidated. And they're probably right. If they think they've already consolidated, they may have. When we look at their loan file, they have an FFEL consolidation loan. So again, this could have only happened before 2010. So if you recently consolidated, this is not going to be applicable. But if you consolidated a long time ago, you remember doing that, you're probably right. You probably did consolidate, but we may still have to consolidate again, which sounds kind of confusing because we don't have a bunch of loans to combine anymore, but the purpose of this consolidation would be to convert from the FFEL loan type to the direct loan type. So it may still be necessary for you to consider consolidating to make sure that we're under the umbrella of this account adjustment.
Yeah. And this is so important, Megan, because like you said, in general, it's a pretty simple thing. In general, you end up in the right place. You know, in general, people have older, newer loans and they are going to be a direct consolidation. But I just had a crazy situation where a young lady had all direct loans. So the direct loans are the ones that are already federally held for sure. But they were really old direct loans. So like Megan said, back in the day, you could either have FFEL or direct. FFEL were a lot more popular pre-2010, and direct seemed to be a little bit more luck of the draw. But this person had all direct loans, and it was so early on when they consolidated, the consolidation turned them into a FFEL consolidation. And I was like, what? And not only was it an FFEL consolidation, it's an FFEL consolidation outside of the federal system. So they went from being in the federal system to the outside the federal system to now they absolutely need to consolidate. There's some people who have, I know, and this is probably not helping to unconfuse people, but some people have FFEL loans that are federally held and they're kind of in the safe zone right now, even though we generally kind of still end up recommending consolidation a lot of times for them as well. But the people who are outside that have the FFEL loans, so that you've had to pay your loans all during COVID, those are the ones that are, they're federal loans, but they're privately held. And so this person ended up with those kind of loans and absolutely needs to consolidate in order to be able to take advantage of the IDR waiver. They're going to have 17 and a half years of credit toward the income driven payment. And that adjustment is going to be a game changer for them. So they got basically 7.5 years to go and their income is low enough that they're going to pay $5,000 total over the next 7.5 years. So it's a very small price to pay over the next 7.5 years to have, you know, $100,000 of debt taken care of. But they would just keep on paying and paying and paying if they were continuing to go on in the FFEL, you know, with the FFEL loan not consolidated.
Yeah. And some of the repayment plans that the FFEL loans can be on, they're very limited. They are only have access to one income-driven plan, income-based repayment, or IBR, which is not the cheapest. It is a 25-year timeline to forgiveness. But what I see a lot of times is sometimes the income-based repayment plan, the payment itself, depending on somebody's income, could be higher than what maybe a standard repayment plan would be. So one of the standard plans or the like graduated repayment plans, they're not an income-driven plan at all. They take your balance and they spread the payments out over a specific period of time. The longest available time frame is 30 years. 30.
Wow.
30 years. So depending on what somebody's balance is, if they switch to a standard plan, the payment could very well be lower than what an income-based repayment plan would be. And so I've had situations where people have said, well, I'm on the cheapest plan for my loans. I don't think I need to consolidate because I'll just get forgiveness with the plan I'm on. And I'm looking at their file and I'm like, you may get credit retroactively right now because of the account adjustment. You know, the standard plan, any repayment plan in the past right now is going to count towards the income-driven plan. But if you're not already at loan forgiveness or not already at the 25-year timeline, you're going to have to get on an income-driven plan to finish out that time. So that's a big misconception right now, too. I've had multiple people in my inbox asking, you know, even people that I've had a consultation for asking, well, why didn't you recommend this plan? It looks to be cheaper than repay or not pay. They're not going to be eligible for pay, but why are you recommending this plan instead of the standard? And it's because the standard is not going to count towards the forgiveness in the future. So you'll just be paying on that until the term runs out, which could be as far as 30 years out from now. So that is not ideal. Of course, we want the lowest payment possible, but it needs to be the lowest payment possible that's also eligible for the forgiveness to carry out the rest of the term.
Yeah, because that's going to be the most cost efficient thing over time. You know, you don't want the lowest payment possible, but then you spend $100,000 extra because you paid an extra 5 years on your loans. And so that's the kind of calculations that we're doing for people to help them better understand and walking you through like, okay, these numbers are here and this one looks nice, but let's talk about the implications related to, you know, this pretty small payment that you're looking at versus maybe a little bit higher payment that overall is going to end up being more cost effective.
Yeah, we're kind of nerding out right now, but sometimes my favorite strategies too, though, are kind of doing a hybrid of the plans where, so for example, if we're working with someone who is planning on retiring in the next, you know, couple years, 5 years, whatever it is, they know that their income is going to decrease in those later years compared to their active income right now, which might be the most money they've ever made because they're at the very end of their career, you know, coming up on retirement. They know retirement income is going to be a lot less because they're withdrawing from different assets or they don't need that full active income. So I find a lot of cases where we might actually recommend the standard plan initially, where we go ahead and get consolidated, get all that credit for prior payment history. But if the income-driven plan right now is too expensive for you, maybe we consider a standard plan until you get to retirement, knowing that like those years until retirement are not going to count towards forgiveness, but you know, they at least keep the loan in good standing. And once we get to a place where your income is lower, we switch to the income driven plan and finish out the forgiveness term. So there's a lot of complexity, of course, but there's a lot of like fun planning we can do to where if like the income driven payment is too much for us right now, what can we do to kind of put a foot in the door to still keep forgiveness as an option down the road for us. So eventually we have like an end in sight, but how do we make sure we can get there without, you know, crushing your bank account right now for whatever circumstance it is. So lots of planning, lots of fun number crunching for us.
100%. And I think this really drives home the point about like how everything is so individualized. So there's not a one size fits all way to handle someone's student loan situation, because no one is doing a one size fits all way of handling their life. You know, some people are having kids, some people are getting married, some people are buying their home, some people are house hacking, you name it. There's all kinds of different strategies out there, and all of those things are going to work and be intertwined with your overall student loan story. All right. So we've talked a little bit about refunds. Had a cool story there. We've talked reconsolidating. So consolidating yet a second time, even though you might have already done it before, and how that could be helpful. Let's talk a little bit about repay and this new repay actually specifically, and how it could be a super duper effective way to pay your loans. So I had a pretty interesting case recently with this new repay where the client had $47,000 worth of debt and $88,000 of income. So if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that in general, if you earn more than you owe, you're probably going to be one of the people that needs to be considering refinancing, paying your loans back more aggressively versus using these forgiveness paths that we talk frequently about. But with the new repay plan, we're getting to see a lot more flexibility because of the way the plan is laid out. So if you've not heard about it before, they're calculating the payment based on 2.25 times the federal poverty rate, whereas all of the other payment plans that existed before this new one that is coming out are calculated based on 1.5 times the federal poverty rate. So that is the big game changer that is lowering payments significantly and allowing people to have a smaller monthly payment, which maximizes the amount of forgiveness that they get. So with this particular couple, they hadn't been doing anything related to retirement. They were trying to get on track for that. We talked about doing HSAs as well. So this $88,000 of income, I think they also were in a community property state and the spouse was staying at home. So we lowered their income quite a bit in order to be able to take advantage of the new repay plan. But it made sense. And it, you know, very, very seldom are you going to get someone that comes to you that's earning double what they actually owe. But one of the income-driven plans makes sense. But I think we're going to start seeing that a lot more with the implementation of the new repay plan.
Yep. So we're still waiting on, you know, this approval of the new repay plan. So it's not something we can jump on yet, but we are starting to have those conversations in anticipation of how the plan was proposed. That way, folks that do a consultation with us now, we know what the plan is going to be if nothing changes, but we also know how we can pivot if this new repay plan does in fact get implemented. So we're kind of having a plan A for like what we know to be true right now, and a plan B for if we find out things change later. So that gives people some peace of mind too. And like knowing that like things will change, of course, because we're talking about federal student loans right now, but that's okay because we know how our plan is going to change. But that's a great point in general, is that it does kind of change, because we would have a rule of thumb where if your balance was lower than your annual income, you are definitely going to be a refinancing case, unless there's some like weird technicalities that maybe that's not the case for everybody. But generally, rule of thumb is that if your balance was a lot lower than your income, you are a refinance case or a pay it down to zero as soon as possible case. It's interesting that the new repay is starting to change that rule of thumb a bit, because it depends on if you have a large family size, that poverty line deduction could be a lot that they're subtracting from your adjusted gross income, which then makes your payment really low. And with the ability to exclude spousal income, with the technicalities of filing taxes separately and you know, in community property states, splitting the income, like there's so many little loopholes, I guess you could say, that help make new repay even sweeter than what it already is. And so it's fun to kind of do the number crunch to see if like our older advice would stand true. And it's the new repay could be a game changer for certain people. Not everybody. It's not going to be the best for everybody. I think that's going to be kind of what the media says when this plan, if and when this plan is approved, they're going to make this seem like it is the best plan for everybody. And that's simply not the case. There are some drawbacks to it, like the 25-year timeline to forgiveness, for example. New repay is going to have a 25-year timeline to forgiveness for graduate students or people with graduate loans, where pay, what exists today, is a 20-year timeline. 5 years is a big difference when it comes to adding up large payments over that 5-year time frame. So it's, you know, again, not the best for everybody, but it is interesting to really model out what this new repay could look like. And we also have a free calculator on our website if you were curious. And if you wanted to make sure that your current strategy is up to par with what's going on right now and kind of stress test what the new repay plan might look like, we can absolutely do that in a consultation together and put together your game plan. Well, awesome. I'm looking forward to the consultations to come, like once we know about this plan. Now, pivoting to refinancing. I think that's our last R for today. our stretch of a cool title for this podcast. So we're going to be talking about refinancing, and then we have a couple other notes to maybe close out our conversation today. So should you be refinancing right now? Should anyone be refinancing right now?
A lot of people are like, no way, Jose. Yeah. Interest rates are astronomical. There's so much unrest in the federal system. And I totally hear you with that. Mm-hmm. Interest rates are a little bit higher than they have been. Well, they were during COVID, but it doesn't mean that there's not a situation where someone should be refinancing. And I had a case recently where someone had a good bit of private debt, with terrible interest rates, 4 loans that were between 12% and 15%. And I think a lot of people aren't even aware that interest rates that high exist with student loans, but that is literally like credit card debt. It's awful.
Yeah. And they're private loans, right? They were all like private. Were they variable rate loans?
Exactly. Private loans and variable rate loans. So they're climbing, they're jumping all over the place. It is not a good situation to have a 15% interest rate on any debt. So that's the debt you want to be trying to pay off aggressively and quickly. And they had no idea that, you know, that they were like, oh, I can make my payment every month. I've been plugging along here. And I'm like, let's plug along way faster at a much lower interest rate. So.
Yeah, definitely take a look at those private student loan interest rates because they can be shocking. Like they may not be what they were when you initially borrowed them because if they're a variable rate loan, they can change. They have the right to change that rate on you. And I've also seen some really nasty rates and a lot of times with undergraduate loans, maybe bar study loans, you know, loans that typically you're not able to borrow federal loans for. So undergrad has much, much lower lending limits on how much you can borrow as an undergraduate student. And so sometimes people have to resort to private student loans if they're not looking at parent plus loans. In private loans, they're based on credit. You have to have a cosigner. Usually the student themselves doesn't have a lot of credit. So a parent is a cosigner. If their credit isn't awesome, if the parent's credit isn't awesome, you know, that could negatively impact what the interest rate is going to be. In general, I think when you're borrowing private student loans before you've graduated, you're a bigger risk to that company. So you have to kind of think about it like that, not to justify the interest rate necessarily, but like from a underwriting perspective, you are risky when you're borrowing an undergraduate loan because you may not graduate. You may not have a job post-graduation that affords you the ability to pay this loan off. So they upcharge you on the interest to kind of compensate them for losses that they will inevitably have for people who are not able to pay those loans in the future. And so the best course of action with private student loans right after graduation, or even sometimes you can refinance while you're still in school. If you're an undergrad person or you're a graduate school person right now with private loans, it's just more difficult and you almost always have to have a cosigner. So it's very rare that you can do it on your own if you're still in school. After school, once you have the degree, if you have a good income, usually you're able to refinance into a lower interest rate. If your credit is decent, you could also utilize a cosigner to help with the interest rate itself. But that is something to definitely look at jumping on now. And rates are going down. We've been seeing them.
I think you had an interesting person that with Parent Plus loans that got a good rate recently.
Yeah. So I had a case. It was technically a pre-debt consultation because we were trying to decide for the last year of this person's daughter's schooling. So he was a parent calling about his daughter's undergraduate schooling. they needed one more year's worth of aid because they didn't have a lot for undergrad that she could borrow under her own name in the federal system. He hadn't entertained Parent PLUS loans before, and he had just gone with private student loans for three of his kids. So he had a bunch of different private student loans at varying interest rates, and we were trying to figure out what to do with this last year. But our conversation had a lot to do with refinancing, looking at refinancing for the existing private student loans that he had. And their decision as a family was he was going to take over these loans for his kids. He was just going to refinance them into his own name, not have a co-signing situation with the kids. That is possible because he's already one of the co-signers on the loan. So he's looking at that. He had done some shopping, and I got an email this past week that he's looking at like 5.1% for a refinance. And some of his were just like your client, Lauren, where they were like 12 to 15%. And we were like, we got to get that chopped down. That's gonna hurt us when it comes to the payback. So easy answer, circling back to who should be refinancing right now. It is people who have private student loans who can get a better rate with refinancing. Even if you haven't graduated, take a peek at it. See if you need a co-signer. You could shop it without committing. On our website, just check out the marketplace. There's a student loan refi bonuses tab where it'll take you to where we've got a lot of companies that we track regularly on where their interest rates are. Apply through the website, see what offers you have. And if you don't get better than what you already have, you do not have to implement a refinancing offer. So it's, you could shop it without committing, which is nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. And I know one of the things that comes up for people frequently is that they feel like, you know, this is a scam of some sort. Like, what's the catch? And it's like with refinancing, you just get a lower interest rate. There's no origination fees. It's not like when you buy a home and you have to have closing costs and all these other kind of hidden kind of crazy fees. And the companies themselves are not scams. That's another thing. They're like, well, which company should I use? What if I get taken advantage of in some way? I would stick to the companies that are reputable. Like you said, we vetted the ones that are on our site, but you absolutely can refinance, like you said, and not have any problems. But to that point, like a lot of people are just nervous in general about scams. And I was thinking about like this idea that, you know, there's so much stuff happening out there in the world that you have to do a little bit of research. I had a client recently who canceled, and they put in the reason for their cancellation. It was that the federal website says not to pay for advice about student loans. And I totally know where the Department of Education is coming from, because there's a lot of crappy stuff happening out there and people are being taken advantage of, and there are student loan scams. But if you do a little bit of research, like you said, if you look into the company, you realize like, oh, SoFi and Earnest and Common Bond are large companies. They have commercials. They are real people there. They actually do refinance loans. In the same way, we get on this podcast every week. We don't live, you know, in a dark cellar somewhere. We're using our real names. We're pretty easy to find via Google, Instagram. You know, you can check our credentials via CFP.net, CSLP. You know, so do a little research so that you can feel comfortable knowing that the place that you're going to for advice or refinancing or whatever the case may be is a place that you can put your confidence in. You know, that's important.
And be wary of free advice, free or really inexpensive advice. That's where you have to start to question, how are they getting paid? Like, what are their incentives for talking to me? Because everyone in this world, most people in this world, have to work for a living to pay their own bills, make their way through life, save for retirement. So if a company or an individual is offering free services, and they're telling you that they're going to get you loan forgiveness, they're going to help you reduce your interest rate, they're going to help reduce your payments, you have to figure out, or have to just think, you know, quick check. Okay, that sounds nice, but how are they doing that? How are they getting compensated for the advice that they're giving me? Because if you're not paying them out of your pocket, they're getting paid somehow. And that's probably through the recommendation that they're giving you. So if they're suggesting, oh, you need to refinance your loans, taking them to a private company, you know, they're probably getting a kickback from that company, or they're probably having some kind of incentive to send you to, you know, to a refinancing, you know, situation, even if it's not the right play. So I think, you know, be wary of free advice, very inexpensive advice, also be aware of certifications. I think now, thankfully, there's a very clear way to know who is very specialized in student loans, and that's through the CSLP designation, or the Certified Student Loan Professional designation. You can Google the CSLP Institute. We've got a directory online where you could find a CSLP, and we have very, I would say, strenuous training in both financial planning aspects of student loans and also like the, not the law side technically, but like really the inner workings of these student loan plans and student loan legislation. And, you know, we've got a lot of background in student loan planning overall as a CSLP. So there's not a cookie cutter answer. There's not a cookie cutter advice, you know, mill, unfortunately. There's, you know, it takes some more like financial planning guidance. And I think that's also where like the little blurb on the studentaid.gov website is a little flawed, because yes, you can call your servicer and you can ask questions. They'll give you factual information about your loans that sometimes is right. Right. But they cannot give you advice. They cannot, they're not financial planners. They do not have financial planning designations or background. They're just your loan servicer. They just manage your loans. And also remember who they're working for. They're contracted by the government. They are not hired by you to give them unbiased advice. They're also, you know, they're not hired to do that. They're not there for that. They're there just to answer questions and collect payments from you. So I hope that clears up some of the wording and the verbiage on studentaid.gov about hiring help, you know, and I think, you know, with hiring help, of course, that is something that we offer here at Student Loan Planner. We are not free. We do charge for our services. We charge a consultation fee, and it comes with 12 months of email correspondence. But I think you said, so you've been working with someone who's, I think, worked with us every year since COVID started. Is that right?
Yeah, they have booked their third consultation and just was ecstatic each time. And so there was not a whole lot that was different in this person's particular life. We generally recommend, you know, if you get married, you have kids, you change jobs, you know, you do something drastic with your income, you know, something completely changes about your situation. We need to recalculate things. That's when we recommend booking a consultation. But if things are relatively the same, you generally shouldn't need one. But they think it's totally worth it to make sure that nothing is missed. So they've been booking peace of mind calls once a year since COVID has started. They're just like, I need to know what's going on with these new changes. I've been reading the emails, but a little bit of it is over my head. I just want to talk about it in my specific situation, and are through the moon, just super excited every time they hang up the phone. They're like, you guys are the best. And I'm like, aww. I'm so glad, because I didn't tell you anything different than what you got the last time, mainly. Yeah. But, you know, I think peace of mind is something that's worth paying for. And to your point, you know, sometimes people are looking for the free resource out there, but you get what you pay for with that as well. So there's this idea of value and cost and price. And, you know, we kind of get these things all mixed up, but you absolutely want to think about what is valuable to you, what cost you're willing to pay to get something that's valuable to you, and what it might cost you to avoid paying a price versus, you know, saying like, hey, let me invest in myself and pay these few dollars to be able to maximize something that's going to be really valuable to me for the long term. So don't be afraid to do what you need to do to get a consultation or to get the peace of mind that's necessary.
Yeah. Think of it as a little health checkup. You know, you're not hoping that when you go to the doctor every year for your physical that something's wrong, right? You're not disappointed if they don't find something. So think about us as that, you know, if you're someone who would like that peace of mind each year. And we also have other folks that, you know, just do consultations when things really do change. Like you said, like those big life changes, those big changes in the student loan system. So it's absolutely not something that you have to do every year, but there could absolutely still be value in it if that gives, that brings you specifically peace of mind. So I think that wraps up for today though, right?
I think we covered it. We gave them a lot of information on refunds, refinancing, repay, and reconsolidating.
Love it. Gosh, anyone who's in marketing is like rolling their eyes at us right now. We're so embarrassing.
Well, if you need us, you know where to find us. We are at studentloanplanner.com. Megan and I are happy to help you, as are any other members of our team. I think we are a party of 10 now. Is that accurate, Megan?
Yeah, we're growing still, guys. Our newest is Scotty. I don't think anyone's heard from Scotty yet, but we will have an introduction podcast here soon so you can meet our newest SLP team member. He's pretty darn awesome. He's got a great story to share about his journey coming into the financial planning space. So thank you guys for hanging out with us today, and we'll catch you in the next week's podcast.